From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Real Dirt on Farmer John is a documentary that will be shown next week on public TV. It's the story of one farmer that tells a larger story about family farms and organic farming. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with that farmer, John Peterson. Also, the second of our two-part interview with former poet laureate Billy Collins. We'll play recordings of Robert Frost and Galway Kinnell reading their work from the new CD box set Poetry on Record, and Collins will read a couple of poems from his latest collection. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Throughout the 1970s and 80s, family farms across the U.S. were disappearing. Some of that land was swallowed up by larger corporate farming operations. Urban sprawl took over other plots of land that used to grow food. Like many farmers, my guest John Peterson sold his farm in the early 80s because he was so deep in debt. The farm had been in his family for generations. Next week, public television stations will air a documentary about Peterson called The Real Dirt on Farmer John, directed by Taggart Siegel. It shows how Peterson was later able to start a successful organic farm, which is now one of the largest community-supported agriculture farms in the U.S. John Peterson took over his family's farm when he was still in high school, after his father died in the late 60s. His family had 350 acres on which it grew corn and soybeans and raised chickens, cows, and hogs. When Peterson went to college, he continued to run the farm. Well, when you took over the farm, you also transformed it in a way. It became a home or a home away from home for a lot of your friends who were, this was like, what, the early 70s maybe? You know, a lot
late
of
60s.
Late 60s, early 70s. Early 70s. And a lot of your friends were hippies. They were artists. And a lot of them, I don't know, they moved onto your farm or they just hung out there a lot?
Some of them camped there. There really wasn't housing on the farm for them, but they hung out there a lot. And then some of these people started farming with me and rented houses in the area. And then we raised crops together. It became a kind of a community that was built around a functioning farm, a rather conventional farm, but with some very unusual people from all over.
Okay, so your farm was a way for a lot of people to live in a beautiful setting or to live out their fantasies about farming or going back to the land. What did the connection to the people who were living on your land mean to you, and how were you changed by knowing all of these kind of like artistic, countercultural, urban people?
Because I was so involved in farming and so fascinated with farming, my response to all of these people being in my lives was, how do we bring this into the farming experience? How do we incorporate all of this exotic influx of cultures and, you know, different ethnicities? How do we bring that into the farming life so that we can broaden farming? And so what happened was I came up with this, or gradually this idea or this concept evolved, which I termed art and agriculture, which was in a way seeing a farm as the foundation for a kind of cultural renewal, or maybe we could say cultural synthesis, but because so much new was coming out of this. And we'd celebrate the solstices and the equinoxes and the harvests. And then, you know, we worked a lot with natural materials. We'd take stone from the quarries and incorporate it into walls and into additions on this one house in particular. And so I felt like we were really getting closer to the earth and bringing these principles of about the earth and about, in a way, agriculture that had maybe been a bit overlooked because agriculture had become so commercial, and we were building a farm out of these broadened principles.
While you were trying to redefine the nature of your farm and make it make the experience more of an artistic as well as an agricultural expression, were you doing pretty traditional farming at the time?
I didn't really examine closely the implications of that. It was something that when in the 50s, when chemicals were starting to come onto the scene, the people in the community were very excited. And they were saying, wow, we can get rid of our quackgrass. We can get rid of our broadleaf weeds. What a great thing. And I remember these lunch conversations when the farmers would sit around and talk about these chemicals and marveling. And because I came from that tradition of wanting to be more effective as a farmer and always trying to figure out how to do less work, because all you do on a farm is work and then notice how much you're not getting done, I was excited about the chemicals too, and about farming effectively through those conventions.
Now, the film says that after a while, after you took over your family farm, you were hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to banks, friends, and loan sharks. What got you so deep into debt?
Optimism.
What do you mean?
Well, my mom would say, back in the 50s and in the early 60s when agriculture was still flourishing a bit, and occasionally you'd see a barn being built in the community, and my mom would say, there's a family that believes in the future. They're building a new barn. And capital is what fuels expansion, and I felt that I could undertake indebtedness. I could undertake it, and that I would somehow be able to, you know, prosper my way out of it, because I had this deep sense of the farm as my destiny, and the thought of losing it was it was actually inaccessible to me. There was really no possibility in my mind, in my being, that this farm could ever be lost. So I was really quite casual in taking on debt to renovate the buildings, to finance the acquisitions of equipment. And, I mean, there were a lot of charts at the time that would justify that kind of expansion. I don't think they would have justified putting money into celebrations and some of the renovation work that we did on the farm. But as far as that kind of expansion, that was very commonplace back then. And there was this idea that a certain scale was essential to survive as a farmer. So I borrowed a lot of money. And then this impossible thing happened. The banks were calling the loans. So this idea that I had, or this, I guess I'd almost have to call it a knowledge, it was challenged. It was, you know, it was exploded.
How did the loan sharks come into? Because you mentioned you owed money to loan sharks, too.
Oh, my. There was at that time when some of the farms were starting to get really shaky in the early 80s, there was, one organization in particular that advertised that it had sources of capital. And desperate people, which I was becoming, will do desperate things. I went to an attorney during that time. I wanted to come up with, I think, $300,000 or $350,000. And he asked me a few questions, and he finally said, well, I can get you the money, but the problem is you don't have children. And I said, well, why is that a problem? He said, well, the people who will lend you the money, they know that they're not going to get far threatening you, but they're going to come to you if you don't repay them, and they're going to threaten to kneecap your children, and they're going to tell you exactly when they get out of school, and they're going to tell you exactly like what they wore to school on certain days, so you will know that your children are under surveillance. And then when the loan is due, you're going to find a way to come up with it, because you're not going to let that happen to your kids. Well, I was so shaken by what I was descending into. So that when I drove away from his office that day, I realized that it was time to put the land up for sale.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Peterson. He's the subject of the new documentary, The Real Dirt on Farmer John. So tell us what it was like. You know, your land was auctioned. You kept, I think, 22 acres and auctioned off the rest. What was it like the day of the auction? Would you describe it for us?
Well, all the equipment was lined up south of the farmstead. And I was in shock, really. I was in a certain kind of denial. And because this farm years earlier had a tradition of bringing people together, because of my mom and my dad and all the picnics we used to have on the farm, the neighborhood picnics, there was an element to it that was like an echo of that in a very perverse way. And a lot of people were there to snoop. And they were looking in the buildings, they were looking through the windows, they were very, very curious about this farm. So here was a social event, a cultural event, a very dark cultural event with the people who I'd grown up with, who had been friends of my parents. And I, at the time, I couldn't really absorb it. I just was looking around feeling like, oh, this is a community event. And then here was this machinery, which I had strong attachments to. I'm a machinery person. I love equipment, and it had been carefully selected and well-maintained, and here was being auctioned. And so I was a mixture of emotions. I mean, I was relieved. I was in this kind of odd state of euphoria, which I can only attribute to shock, because later, when I was decompressing, I went into a very, very dark, morbid space about this. And it's interesting, when all this equipment was being pulled down the driveway and leaving the farm, there's something about not farming that appealed to me. It was a relief. It was a big relief, and I just saw this big, and I'm not going to say opportunity in life. I call it a hole, but at least it wasn't something that was loaded with debt and threats and involvements with loan sharks. It was a very different space that I was now going into.
Looking back on that time now, do you think the fact that you ended up so deep in debt and that you had to sell a farm, do you think that has more to do with the larger, like, social and economic forces that were prevailing in family farms at the time, or do you think it was something unique to your situation?
Well, a lot of farms went down then.
Exactly,
I was more vulnerable because of... I had spent money on things besides expanding the farm, and I'd been a bit diverted from farming, even though I loved that. But I was financing some other things, activities on the farm, that heightened my debt load, which turned out to be fortunate, because if I'd gone down a couple of years later, when land values had completely collapsed, there wouldn't have been anything left, and there wouldn't be a film about the resurrection of a farm. So I was forced out right at the beginning. And it's not that I think that this is a good argument for extravagance or for having a lot of festivals, but I do notice that it did cause a certain type of fortune to come my way. I got out when there was still some value left in the land.
My guest is John Peterson. He's the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Farmer John, which will be shown next week on public TV stations. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Peterson. He's the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Farmer John, which will be shown next week on public TV stations. Like many farmers in the 1980s, he had to sell his farm after getting deep in debt. You were very depressed after you sold the farm. You traveled for a few years. Eventually, you decided you wanted to become a farmer again, and you wanted to buy the land back. So, and you succeeded. I don't know whether you bought all of it back or, like, was it exactly the same land that you bought back?
No. The land has actually been acquired by various friends and members of the farm community, the community support agriculture community. I never really cared that much about reclaiming the land. There's something about that kind of ownership that I think I got over. I wanted to farm. I wanted to be involved with the land, and that requires having some security with the land, some continuity. And so the land that's been acquired contiguous to the 22 acres is all, or almost all, land that's in long-term leases, and it's quite secure in terms of my knowing that I can farm it year after year.
So when you went back and started farming again, eventually you got into not only organic farming, but a community-supported agriculture group, which we'll talk about in a second. But did you try to be your father for a while first? Like, when you went back to farming, did you try to do it your father's way, to do it the traditional way, or the traditional chemical way? I don't know exactly what word to use for that. To do it like your dad did.
Well, no. No, I didn't want to farm conventionally. I didn't want to farm with chemicals. I knew that. And I know that I'm like, I don't want these crops in this soil propped up with what they call now crop protectors. But back then they just called them like ag chemicals. I didn't want that. I wanted to be in this space where I was dealing with what I saw was what I was truly dealing with, not a mirage.
But for a while, you were beset with plagues of all kinds of bugs. So how did you turn that around?
Well, a lot of layers of management. Fertility practices, row covers. In organic farming, there are microbial insecticides that are permissible to use that parasitize larvae. Rotation, learning a lot, but really building the soil up more. We adopted biodynamic practices, which seems to enhance the health of the plants. So there are a lot of things that we had to put in place. It was a tremendous learning curve. I had not raised vegetables. There's all this diversity to manage. I had not farmed organically. And I also had the sense of scale that I could start off pretty big, which I was not humble enough to know that I should have started small. So tremendous learning curve. And after a few years, we started having good results.
You eventually became a CSA, a community-supported agriculture group. And this was at the suggestion of some city people who wanted to have this kind of arrangement, have this kind of relationship with your farm. For people who don't know what a CSA is, would you describe it?
Stands for community-supported agriculture. And it's a program where people sign up with the farm for a whole season. And usually it's to get vegetables from the farm, but not always. And they pay in advance to help capitalize the farm's needs for that growing season. And they enter into a relationship with the farmer and with the farm. So it's a kind of a covenant that people enter into with a piece of land. In our case, there are many people who sign up for many years in advance. We have a lot of people actually who have signed up with our farm for the next 5 years and paid for that membership.
So people pay. That helps subsidize your farm, and in return they get like a box of food every week, a box of fresh vegetables?
That's right. And they take on some risk. They agree that they'll accept what the farm provides that year. So it might be a great year, it might be a poor year. In our case, because we have enough of a land base, because our customers stepped up and bought a nice piece of land next door, we have half our land fallow every year. So we have a fantastic fertility system. So the last several years, we've just had fantastic abundance on my farm. So even though the people who sign up with our farm accept the risk, they have not had to, and they have not encountered any shortfalls for many years.
So is the money they pay enough to keep the farm going, or is that just a part of the solution to keeping it going?
Well, it's part of the solution. I mean, it does seem like it's kept some farms afloat. It's certainly brought some farms into being that otherwise never would have been there. There's, I believe, 2,000 to 3,000 CSA farms in the country now. And there are a lot of things that happen out of it. One, the source of capital does not have to go, it doesn't come from a bank. It's person to person. So it's a warm, personal source of capital. Two, it brings the customer into an understanding of the farm, because you know the weather that starts happening on that farm starts to be the shareholders' weather, and the crops are the shareholders' crops, or the customers' crops. So a lot of things happen that build this relationship between the farmer and the consumer that can empower farms in a lot of different ways. So often the shareholders will figure out how to help capitalize the farm in other ways.
John Peterson is the subject of the new documentary, The Real Dirt on Farmer John. It will be shown next week on public TV stations. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, former poet laureate Billy Collins reads from his latest collection. We'll also listen to and talk about recordings of Robert Frost and Galway Kinnell reading their poems. And we continue our conversation about farming with John Peterson. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Peterson. He's the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Farmer John, which will be shown next week on public television. It tells the story of how, like many farmers in the 1980s, he went into debt and had to sell the family farm. Now he runs a large and successful organic farm. There was a period after you returned to farming when some of your neighbors were pretty hostile, because you, again, had friends working and living on the farm, and because it wasn't a traditional family kind of farm. You were accused of housing devil worshippers, and people thought it was a cult group. What does it do to you when some of your neighbors in this kind of rural setting think that you're crazy and evil and demonic?
Well, Actually, that hysteria started before I started up the farm again. So there were about 7 years that passed between when the farm went down and then when I started it up again as an organic farm. And a lot of other farms went down during that period. And there was quite a, I guess I'll call it a collective shadow that formed out of all that loss. And there was a lot of grief and there was a lot of confusion. And I think what happened was, rather than people take responsibility or just accept what was happening, they needed a place to project that shadow. And my farm was the right candidate. And so this dominated my life when I was on that farm for several years. And I just saw how a community can really go down and become deranged. You know, I actually became a bit deranged myself out of what was happening. But just to create a picture of it, on a nightly basis, there were kids driving in to my farm, sometimes several times a night, screaming out their window, the devil, Satan, throwing firecrackers, shooting rockets at the buildings. People were actually walking around on my farm, digging holes in the fields, looking for bones. There were a lot of
bones of
from
the dead
deputies.
People you allegedly killed and buried. Is that it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And this just escalated. And I thought, well, how could this be escalating? I'm not interested in devil worship. I'm not a drug runner. I'm just someone who lost a farm.
How'd you turn that around?
Well, we had a fire on the farm, this beautiful cabin, which was a very sacred place that I had built in the woods about 12 years earlier, burned. And it was a cathartic fire, a cathartic event for me. This happened when a lot of other things were sort of crystallizing or actually reaching such an extreme hysterical point that I felt like I was losing my mind. This is my community. And then this beautiful, beautiful home burned. My friend lost all of her paintings from her whole life, all of her journals. And something snapped. And I realized in just an instant, I realized that I had to stop these visits to the farm. So the visits were coming from two sources, the kids and the deputies. I thought, okay, I'm going to go to the sheriff, and I'm going to confront him, and I'm going to seek his help. And I went down to the sheriff, and I just stormed into his office, and I confronted him. And here was this, you know, person that, in right in front of him, person to person, who I think had really been kind of an enemy and definitely a suspect in his world because the whole community had all this suspicion about me. And there I was saying there was a fire, and I said, you can come to my farm and you can open every drawer and look into every closet and you can explore it all you want. And then you're going to figure out that I'm not involved in any of these things the community says I'm involved in. And then I want you to get on my side. And he was, you know, this is the great thing about humanity. It's a very human moment. He just, you know, after I said my piece, and I was quite aggressive or assertive, he said, I'll do it. I'll arrest people who are bothering you. I'll take care of you. I'll look out for you. And that's where it turned around the community, because he just started arresting people. And then the word got out that if you went to the Peterson farm to bite the heads off of squirrels or to throw firecrackers at the buildings, you're going to get arrested. And it died down pretty quickly. I mean, it took a long time to die down completely, but at least made it so that it was, settled enough so I could start farming there.
Just describe for us what the land around your land is like now. Is it still family farms, corporate farms? Is it condos? What is it?
The land is, these fairly big tracts are being bought up for people to plunk one big house down on. We don't have subdivisions nearby. There are restrictions against that in our township. But further out, like within a few miles, there are a lot of subdivisions. A lot of the farmland is being paved over. But in my community, there aren't many farms left. Very few working farms. Ironically, we're one of the few. And the land still has a somewhat pastoral quality, but the barns are certainly caving in. The farmhouses are caving in. And there's a new kind of a kind of a gentrification that's going on in that area.
John Peterson, thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with your farm.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
John Peterson is the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Farmer John. It will be shown on public television's Independent Lens series next week. Peterson also has a cookbook called The Real Dirt on Vegetables. Before we get to part two of our interview with former poet laureate Billy Collins, there's a new recording I want to play for you. It's a duet with Becky Kilgore, who's performed several concerts on Fresh Air, and the guitarist and singer Eddie Erickson from Erickson's new album, It's a Great Feeling.
Hey, Eddie, how do you feel?
Oh, I feel so great.
Really?
Unbelievable.
It's a pretty nice day, isn't it?
This is a beautiful day. The birds are chirping and the sun is shining. Wow. What about you?
Well, you know what? I'm going to tell you how I feel.
Tell me.
It's a great feeling to suddenly find the clouds are silver lined when the sun breaks through.
You have a way of putting things. It's a great feeling to walk down the street and see the folks you meet smiling back at you.
I know, that's nice.
Isn't that nice? As long as I have someone to embrace.
As far as I'm concerned, the world is such a lovely place. It's a great feeling.
Oh, it sure
is. Your credit is nil, you'll never make a mill.
I hope not.
But nonetheless, I stay.
Oh, what are you gonna state?
When you're in love, you're feeling great.
Coming up, former poet laureate Billy Collins. This is Fresh Air. There's a new CD box set that features recordings of many great poets from throughout the 20th century reading their own work. It's called Poetry on Record. We invited former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins to choose some of his favorite recordings from the box. In part two of our interview, we're going to hear a couple of more selections, and Collins will read from his latest collection of poems, which is called The Trouble with Poetry. Billy Collins is currently New York State Poet Laureate. Billy, the next poem you've chosen is by Robert Frost, and this is a very famous poem of his, The Road Not Taken. Why did you choose this poem? You know, it's one of those poems in a way that's so popular, people sometimes don't even hear it when they hear it. It's
true.
A poem that's easy to take for granted and not really pay attention to in that sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's also a poem that, it's like the Star Spangled Banner in a way that you don't really listen to the lyrics or think about them much. It's also a poem that's very easily understood, and we won't have to go into that, but people take it as a cry toward individuality. You should take the road less traveled by and be an individual and go to your beat your own drum and all that. But if you look closely at the poem, he really emphasizes the fact that these two paths are really look about the same in many ways. And so the choice is not really a clear one.
This is the poem with that famous line about two roads diverged in the woods, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. That's the part you're referring to.
That's right. Although at the end, he says that I'll be telling this ages and ages hence. In other words, this is what I'll be saying about it later. He is not really saying it now. It's a very complicated poem.
And this recording was made in 1941. I think a lot of us grew up hearing Robert Frost as an old man. And so it's interesting to hear him as a younger man.
Yes, this is one of the Library of Congress recordings. They have a huge archive of recorded poetry. And yes, this is 20-something years before his death.
Okay, so let's hear Robert Frost reading The Road Not Taken.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Billy Collins, I'm sure you've read this poem many times. Mm-hmm. Over your life as a poet and teacher, has the poem, the sound of it, the language of it, the meaning of it changed for you over the years?
Well, I think the big, just in that one shift, I mean, I think like most readers, when I read it, say, in high school or maybe in college, I thought it was this cry for doing your own thing, being an independent person and doing the, you know, kind of a cry for American individualism. And the big change occurred when I kept looking at the more I looked at the poem, the more it seemed like these two paths are the same path or just two paths that are indistinguishable. And he doesn't know really what the difference is. It made all the difference, but we don't know what difference that is. We don't know if it's for better or worse.
Billy, the final poem that you've chosen is by Galway Kinnell. And this is called After Making Love, We Hear Footsteps. Tell us a little bit about Galway Kinnell and why you've chosen this poem.
Two things. I love the poem, and I love Galway Kinnell, he's a terrific reader. We were saying that some poets don't do justice to their poems, and perhaps it was a little like silent movie stars when they made talkies, you know, that some of them were tall, dark, and handsome, but they had the voices of cartoon characters, so their careers ended with the silent films. But Galway Kinnell is just a terrific reader. He has a sonorous, confident voice that bears his poetry forth in a very convincing way. And the poem is a lovely domestic marital poem, which has lovely detail, like the boy's pajamas, but also this larger thrust, which is the blessing of having children.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is Galway Kinnell reading After Making Love, We Hear Footsteps.
After making love, we hear footsteps. For I can snore like a bullhorn, or play loud music, or sit up talking with any reasonably sober Irishman, and Fergus will only sink deeper into his dreamless sleep, which goes by all in one flash. But let there be that heavy breathing or a stifled come cry anywhere in the house, and he will wrench himself awake and make for it on the run. As now, we lie together after making love, quiet, touching down the length of our bodies, familiar touch of the long married, and he appears in his baseball pajamas, it happens, the neck opening so small he has to screw them on, and flops down between us and hugs us and snuggles himself to sleep, his face gleaming with satisfaction at being this very child. In the half-darkness, we look at each other and smile and touch arms across this little startlingly muscled body, this one whom habit of memory propels to the ground of his making. Sleeper, only the mortal sounds can sing awake. This blessing love gives again into our arms.
It's Galway Canal, recorded in 1996, and it's one of the readings featured on the new box set Poetry on Record. 98 poets read their work. And with us is Billy Collins, the former U.S. Poet Laureate, current Poet Laureate of New York, and his latest collection of poems is called The Trouble with Poetry. You know, hearing you talk about the poems that we've been playing from this box set makes me really wish that I had a chance to study poetry with you in college. You've taught for many years. Am I right in saying you recently retired?
Yeah, sort of semi-retired. I'm going to go back and teach next semester, but I've I'm just about to put down the chalk for good. But I still visit a lot of colleges, and I still love teaching and making contact with students.
When you think of looking ahead to retirement, what do you think about how you'd structure your day?
Well, I hate to quote Max Beerbohm again, but he was the one who said that the hardest thing about being a poet is knowing what to do with the other 23 and a half hours of the day. But if you're a poet, you know, have to fill in that time. I mean, we have certain obligations, like looking at clouds and kicking acorns, and daydreaming can while away the hours.
Do you get a little crazy when you have too much time to daydream?
Oh, no.
One's mind can turn to the wrong thoughts.
Oh, no. I get, I like to get bored. I find that boredom results in creativity. I can't get very creative unless that's preceded by a really flat period where there's very little going on, this kind of, you know, tumbleweed watching blankness. And it's really out of that creative stuff seems to happen rather than having a busy mind.
Well, there's a poem I'd like you to read from your latest collection, and the collection's called The Trouble with Poetry. This is a poem called Bereft. Would you tell us about writing this poem?
I don't know if I remember much about writing it, except that it's really just about the same theme that I seem to write about all the time, which is, I think someone said that poetry is about how great it is to be alive and how terrible it is going to be to be dead. I think it's just about that. I find it a little hard to talk about my own poems. I think to get someone interested in talking about their own writing, it's a little like trying to get, if you've ever tried to get a dog to look in the mirror, you know, if you have a puppy and you say, look at you, you're so cute, look at the mirror. No, go ahead, look. And they just are looking at you. They just they wonder why you're holding on to them like that. And they have no interest in looking in the mirror. I mean, parakeets like looking in the mirror, but I think writers are maybe more like dogs, that they don't want to look at themselves too often.
Well, but one thing about the poem, was it written shortly after a funeral?
Oh, no. Oh, no. I mean, death is the all-consuming topic of poetry, and so poets are in a constant state of funeral.
And with me laughing away here, let's hear this really beautiful and reflective poem.
Okay.
Which is called Bereft.
Bereft. I liked listening to you at lunch today as you talked about the dead, the lucky dead, you called them, citing their freedom from rent and furniture, no need for doorknobs, no shovels, or windows in a field beyond, no more railway ticket in an inside pocket, no more railway, no more tickets, no more pockets, no more bee chasing you around the garden, no more you chasing your hat around a corner, no bright moon on the glimmering water, no cool breast felt beneath an open robe, more like an empty zone that souls traverse, a vaporous place at the end of a dark tunnel, a region of silence, except for the occasional beating of wings. And I wanted to add, as the sun dazzled your lifted wine glass, the sound of the newcomers weeping.
That's Billy Collins reading a poem from his latest collection, which is called The Trouble with Poetry. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is former U.S. Poet Laureate and current New York State Poet Laureate, Billy Collins. Since we spend so much time talking about poetry, I thought it would be fitting to close with the title poem from your latest collection, The Trouble with Poetry. I know you don't like to talk a lot about your poems, but I'm going to nevertheless ask you to introduce it for us.
It's sort of an anti-poetry poem in a way. I mean, it's a little ambiguous, but I think part of the fun I have in writing poems is that you can make fun of other poets, and poetry is an opportunity to take oneself so absurdly seriously that I can't help kind of mocking the whole enterprise at times. And I think that was maybe the spirit of the poem.
Why don't you read it for us?
I'd love to. It's called The Trouble with Poetry. The trouble with poetry, I realized as I walked along a beach one night, cold Florida sand under my bare feet, a show of stars in the sky. The trouble with poetry is that it encourages the writing of more poetry, more guppies crowding the fish tank, more baby rabbits hopping out of their mothers into the dewy grass. And how will it ever end unless the day finally arrives when we have compared everything in the world to everything else in the world, and there is nothing left to do then but quietly close our notebooks and sit with our hands folded on our desks. Poetry fills me with joy, and I rise like a feather in the wind. Poetry fills me with sorrow, and I sink like a chain flung from a bridge. But mostly, poetry fills me with the urge to write poetry, to sit in the dark and wait for a little flame to appear at the tip of my pencil. And along with that, the longing to steal, to break into the poems of others with a flashlight and a ski mask. And what an unmerry band of thieves we are, cut purses, common shoplifters, I thought to myself as a cold wave swirled around my feet and the lighthouse moved its megaphone over the sea, which is an image I stole directly from Lawrence Ferlinghetti, to be perfectly honest for a moment, the bicycling poet of San Francisco, whose little amusement park of a book I used to carry in a side pocket of my uniform up and down the treacherous halls of high school.
Oh, what a great poem.
Thank you.
And did you carry Ferlinghetti's Coney Island of the Mind around with you, and what did it mean to you?
Absolutely. And a little City Lights edition would fit right into your jacket pocket. Well, that was when I was in high school, and that was when Beat Poetry came out, and it had an explosive effect on it. Just blew all those school poems apart. So when I read Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti, naturally I just wanted to be like them, so I began writing these kind of, I want to be a beatnik poems. Those were probably the first poets I really started imitating.
Billy Collins, you were Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2003. You served two terms.
Yes.
So now that that's, a few years behind you, can you look back and tell us what impact you think it had on you as a poet and just as a guy?
Well, as a guy, it took up so much time. I was I was interviewed a lot. That's the main thing that changed.
Guilty.
People wanted, yeah, but you could interview me, wake me up in the middle of the night and interview me. But you're interviewed a lot and ask questions that are a little beyond your depth, or at least my depth, about the future of American poetry and these other large, ponderous questions. You get so busy doing these kind of social, like poetry promotion things, that I began to suspect that what the Poet Laureate office really was, it was a government plot to silence one poet. So that they would pick out kind of a productive poet who seemed to be, doing well, and they'd saddle you with this job so that you'd be impossible to write any poems for 2 years. I think even after you're finished with your tenure as Poet Laureate, you're kind of always the former poet laureate. You know, it's a little like being the former Miss Kentucky. You know, you can, you know, your teeth can be falling out and you can have a wig on sideways, but you can still say I was Miss Kentucky in 1927, you know. So it sort of follows you around afterward.
Well, Billy Collins, I love your poems. Thank you so much for reading your poetry and for talking with us about poetry today. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Terry.
Billy Collins' latest collection of poems is called The Trouble with Poetry. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending today's show with music by pianist Hilton Ruiz. He died yesterday after suffering severe head injuries last month in New Orleans, which the police attributed to a fall. Ruiz was known for his virtuosity in both jazz and Latin music. Hilton Ruiz was 54 years old.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of A World Undone, The Story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, by G.J. Meyer. From Capella University, an accredited university committed to delivering academic excellence online at capella.edu. And from Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Kevin Kline, Virginia Madsen, and Meryl Streep. Opening June 9th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes.
On the next Fresh Air, Harry Connick Jr. talks about his Tony-nominated performance in The Pajama Game, and John Lasseter talks about directing his new animated film, Cars. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Hey there.